Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
I believe that a bird should be beautiful, but it should be useful as well. They're egg layers. It's important for them to have that quality. So there's more than just a perfect comb or perfect color.
Jana Wilson raises a couple dozen rare chickens on her small farm. She's concerned with the quality of the birds' combs because she enters them in poultry competitions. Asian carp are taking over U.S. waterways. Harvest Public Media wonders if the solution is to sell the fish for food to the Chinese. Ahead of Cinco de Mayo, we talk with food historian Jeffrey Pilcher about the workhorse of Mexican cuisine, the corn tortilla. And then Kate Young of Mother Hubbard's Cupboard grabs a 2-pound bag of masa and shows us just how easy it is to fry up some tortillas yourself. Our reporters Chad Bouchard and Liz Leslie follow food news stories throughout the week. Luann Johnson brings us a summary.
More than 1 million Indiana residents don't know where their next meal will come from or when it will come, according to a report released last week from Feeding America. Nearly 16% of Hoosiers are food insecure, and that includes nearly 346,000 children. More than half likely qualify for federal assistance, such as food stamps, but 31% of those considered food insecure earn income above federal assistance eligibility levels, meaning their only access to help comes from charitable organizations. Nationwide, food insecurity is at 16%, or almost 49 million people. 4 years after the FDA first considered a proposal to raise genetically modified salmon, no decision has been made. What gives? Here's a little background. If approved, Aqua Advantage salmon would be the first genetically modified animal sold for human consumption. The fish in question is an Atlantic salmon that carries a transplanted growth hormone gene from a Chinook salmon and a gene from an eel-like fish that produces an antifreeze protein. The company says their creation grows twice as fast as other farmed salmon, though opponents and competitors have questioned those claims. The FDA held its first meeting about the proposal in 2010, but after 4 years, there's still no indication when a decision might come down. During that time, a cluster of food policy watchdogs has galvanized against the proposal, saying the product could pose health and environmental risks that were not rigorously considered. Supporters dismiss these objections and say such a prolonged delay is unfair to Aqua Bounty, the company that developed the fish. Initial statements about the proposal 4 years ago seemed to indicate that the FDA would likely greenlight the proposal, but the agency's second draft environmental assessment in 2012 covered new information, and the FDA has repeatedly declared it hasn't made a decision. There's so much more to this story. The environmental impact of genetically engineered fish, potential safety concerns for consumers. Earth Eats Chad Bouchard has the full story at eartheats.org. And with Cinco de Mayo on the horizon, a nationwide lime shortage has bars and restaurants nervous. Colin Boalini, owner of Bloomington's The Rail, says he used to buy a 110-count box of limes for $40, but the price has skyrocketed to well over $100 in the past several weeks. The vast majority of our limes come from Mexico, which has been dealing with bad weather, disease, and possibly drug cartel violence, all of which translate to increased costs to distributors and consumers. Purdue horticulture professor Bruce Bordelon says after the passage of NAFTA, cheaply grown limes in Mexico gradually took over the market. Additional disasters like hurricanes and disease destroyed the homegrown market. In recent years, there's been a small resurgence in lime growing in Florida, but it's nowhere near big enough to relieve the current shortage. Follow us on Twitter to get food news updates all day, every day. We're at Earth Eats.
And we're on Facebook. Search for Earth Eats. Thanks, Luann Johnson.
You got it.
Water experts in the Midwest are worried about Asian carp. They say the invasive fish are taking over U.S. waterways, the Mississippi River and its tributaries like the Illinois and Missouri rivers, where they outcompete native fish. But as Jacob McClellan reports for Harvest Public Media, river watchers at their wits' end have found new hope, and it lies on dinner tables in China.
Jeff Smith rolls a rack full of Asian carp up a ramp at a processing plant in Wickliffe, Kentucky. condensation billows as Smith cracks open a flash freezer. He walks inside, adding this latest catch to hundreds of others.
90% of what we sell is imported to China. We got some that'll be going to Chicago and New York.
Two Rivers Fisheries opened here last year, near the point where the Ohio River flows into the Mississippi. Next to the freezer, a container is full of 45,000 pounds of carp. It will soon begin the six-week journey to Asian markets. Carp is fairly cheap and common in Chinese cooking. Smith says Chinese customers like his carp because they're big. Most carp in China are farmed and grow to about 2 pounds. His fish weigh between 15 and 25 pounds.
And the taste is different. Just like catfish that's raised in a pond here, it doesn't have the flavor that wild-caught catfish does. It does not have the intensity of the flavor.
Last year, Two Rivers shipped 250 tons to China. This year, they hope to up that to 2,000. Wild carp is hard to come by in China, but they're spreading like wildfire across American waterways.
This is a countrywide concern. We're not talking about just the Midwest.
That's James Garvey, a fisheries researcher at Southern Illinois University. Asian carp make up over 60% of the fish in the lower Illinois River by weight. 60%. And he thinks that number applies to other areas where they're established.
These fish, and every study that's been done, have been shown that they can pretty much cover the entire United States. They're already a problem in some of the western states. Minnesota is very concerned. Missouri's concerned. Nebraska, Kansas have had them and still have them.
There's an electric barrier on the Illinois River to keep them out of the Great Lakes, and Garvey says so far it's been successful. Other fixes include water guns, poisons, and injecting carbon dioxide into the water, but those technologies aren't ready yet.
Harvest seems to be our only method right now for really taking these fish down.
The Asian carp industry is still in its infancy. There are a few other plants, mostly in Illinois. There's even one that makes Asian carp hot dogs. But fish research biologist Dwayne Chapman with the U.S. Geological Survey says commercial fishermen have to catch a lot of Asian carp to make ends meet.
It's very hard work, very, very hard labor, but it takes a lot of skill. It's not something you pick up overnight. And so it's hard to gear up in terms of the number and skill level of the fishermen to do, too.
And the infrastructure to get these fish to market isn't quite there yet. Fishermen may have to travel miles and miles to get their catch to a processor.
The fish as a fillet, they're a little bony, but you can get around the bones because they're really big.
James Garvey at Southern Illinois says while the Chinese market is the most promising right now, it doesn't have to be that way.
My preference is to cook them like a Thai style or a Chinese style, where it's with a lot of soy sauce or ginger or things like that. It's pretty much the best fish I've ever had, honestly. I'm not lying.
But we'll need a lot more adventurous American fish eaters to stem the tide of Asian carp. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Jacob McClelland.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration focused on issues of food, fuel, and field. More stories like this one at harvestpublicmedia.org. There is a lot happening on Jana Wilson's chicken farm these days. She's preparing a couple young hens called pullets to compete in a poultry show at the end of the month. She sold three of her Sicilian buttercup chicks to someone in California, so they're getting ready for that long flight. And of course, lots of hatching little chicken fluff balls. If you're wondering if she names all her birds, well, no.
I actually had one killed who was named after my great aunt, and so after Aunt Georgie got killed, we decided not to name anymore.
Maybe for the best.
Yeah.
That and Jana Wilson just has too many birds to name. Right now, it's 30 on her 20 acres of land outside Bloomington.
So here, come back. I'll show you.
She raises Sicilian buttercups to compete in chicken shows.
A chicken show is like a beauty show, and they have to have all the right beauty attributes. And there's nothing wrong with any of the other birds that don't make the cut, and they all go to lovely homes.
The Bible for showing chickens is the American Poultry Association's Standard of Perfection, which defines all the characteristics that make a breed unique.
Because I've chosen Sicilian buttercups, I have basically tried to memorize all these qualities. You know, you're looking for certain things, the way they hold their tail, you know, certain have to have a completely closed circular comb. See her earlobes?
Uh-huh.
They're white. Do you see the white? But those are her earlobes in the buttercup. The standard of perfection says that they have to be white. So I've had some that have red earlobes, and those are ones that don't go onto the show ring.
So. You say you're breeding to get the best looking hens. What's that process like?
Well, oh, it's all, you have to experiment a lot. I mean, I'll take the birds that are the closest to the standard, and I will breed them together. But I use sometimes several different males, maybe three or four, and all of their offspring I put bands on, and I know what their lineage is. So I put together different combinations, and I make notes, and then you decide, okay, well, this pairing was successful, but this one wasn't. And so next year, you try it again, things like that.
This is an involved hobby.
Yeah, it is. Well, it doesn't have to be for everybody, but you know, I've been raising chickens this is my 12th year. I believe that a bird should be beautiful, but it should be useful as well. So I don't breed birds just for beauty's sake alone. I mean, I want them to be useful. And so if egg laying is what they're egg layers, it's important for them to have that quality. So I look for that too. So there's more than just a perfect comb or perfect color, things like that. So,
well, speaking of usefulness, are you eating any of these chickens?
Yes, I am. I am. It took me a while to get to that point. When I first started raising chickens, my brother reminded me recently, he's a hunter out and he lives out west, and he reminded me that I wouldn't even eat chicken for a while. I think at some point I got to the point where, in fact, someone said to me, you know, it's like raising tomatoes and then giving them away and going to the farmer's market and buying more. So last year, for the first time, I learned how to butcher, and we, this winter, had some very lovely chicken and noodles and chicken soup, and it was great.
Sicilian buttercups are considered a threatened breed by the American Livestock Breed Conservancy, which means there are fewer than 1,000 breeding birds in the U.S. and an estimated global population less than 5,000. 12 breeds are listed as critical. Wilson says she's often one of a few, or perhaps even the only, exhibitor to show Sicilian buttercups at some competitions.
What happens is I'll take these birds to a show, and I'll have sometimes an older gentleman will come up to me and say, I haven't seen one of those in 50 years. And people really get a kick out of seeing these birds that they may have seen pictures of them, but they've not ever seen them in real life. So I just think it's a matter of getting people interested in different breeds. And it's happening. I get emails, I probably get one or two a week at least from people who are looking for buttercups. They're interested in them.
Small-time chicken farmer and poultry show enthusiast Jana Wilson. She also introduced us to her baby chicks, which are adorable, of course. See pictures of those little guys at eartheats.org. Coming up, tortilla etiquette.
I would love to tell you how to properly fold a corn tortilla, but in fact, everyone does it differently.
Well, okay. Historian Jeffrey Pilcher has a couple suggestions for us. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. At the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, massage and yoga. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Bloomington Hypnosis, with certified hypnotist and self-hypnosis instructor John Hunkler, helping clients relax into weight loss for health and fitness. Bloomington Hypnosis, 812-200-5005. It's Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. We talk to authors all the time. Our latest conversation was with Will Fellows, author of Farm Boys, Lives of Gay Men from the Rural Midwest.
I grew up on a dairy farm in south central Wisconsin that the farm had been in my dad's family since the 1850s. It continues to be a dairy farm and with significant crop production, primarily corn and soybeans, as you might expect.
He left his family's farm to attend college, and now he lives in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. But he's always felt a connection to that part of his past. He wrote Farm Boys back in 1996. It's a collection of life stories of gay men from the rural Midwest. Fellows said many of the people he spoke with didn't feel comfortable anywhere.
While they couldn't ever feel quite at home on the farm as the sort of individuals that they were, neither could they feel completely at home in the city. And so they always kind of felt like they were kind of straddling two worlds in which they didn't quite fit.
Here's 1 minute with Will Fellows, where he introduces us to one man he profiled in his book, Farm Boys.
That gentleman is now retired, and last I knew, he's living in Florida. But he grew up in Indiana. He worked in the Midwest, not just in Indiana, but in some other states as well, for years. And he always wore a mask. He was always kind of, if you will, closeted about who he was. And he decided that he was going to come out as at the time of his retirement. He was going to let people know that this person that they had worked so closely with and had such respect for and liked so much was a gay man. And that's, I think, one of the most significant things about the Farm Boys book, is that it does demonstrate that kind of almost embarrassingly naive notion that gay people are these kind of weird products of urban environments that have nothing to do with rural life or farm communities is just a ridiculous proposition. Thanks, Annie.
Thanks. Have a good one.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Will Fellows is the author of Farm Boys. Information on his website, willfellows.com. We're prepping for Cinco de Mayo today with corn tortillas. First, a history lesson with Jeffrey Pilcher, and then a cooking lesson with Kate Young. Pilcher is the author of Planet Taco, A Global History of Mexican Food. We'll focus on Mexican food in America, which is fitting because Cinco de Mayo is a holiday that came out of the Mexican-American community. And you know what else came out of the Mexican-American community? The taco shell. Pilcher had read Glenn Bell's authorized biography, yes, the founder of Taco Bell, where Bell claimed that he invented the taco shell as a way of McDonaldizing Mexican food, you know, speeding up the production. But Pilcher wasn't satisfied with that explanation.
What I did was I went back to the patent office records to see, you know, who was the first person to patent a taco shell. And it turned out that it was actually patented in the 1940s before Glenn Bell ever, you know, he was back there, you know, running a little hamburger shop in San Bernardino. The really interesting thing, though, was that it was patented by a guy named Juvencio Maldonado, a Mexican restaurateur. And I should say, his restaurant was in New York City, which kind of gives you a whole new view of sort of Mexican food in America. The taco shell really comes out of the Mexican-American community, and there are actually cookbooks, one written by a New Mexico Hispanic woman named Fabiola Cabeza de Vaca, who is a home economist who invented the taco shell back in the 30s.
Going back even further, people in Mexico have been eating and making corn tortillas for centuries. All his research, however, did not give him the skills to make corn tortillas from scratch.
Really? I mean, it's one of these peasant foods where you kind of have to learn from childhood to do it. There are a number of steps, and it's actually a very labor-intensive process. So traditionally, women would soak the corn and make a dough, but then they had to grind it by hand on these grinding stones. And this was, I mean, hours of real intense physical labor. Then once the dough had been made, they would roll little balls about the size of a golf ball, and they would pat it out between their hands back and forth. Now, I've actually tried doing that patting myself. So you can either push too hard, in which case it becomes, you know, kind of squeezed into your hand and it just sticks. Or if you try to do the light touch so that it doesn't stick to your hand, it eventually will go flying off like a frisbee. So pat it out 33 times, to make these round tortillas, you know, flat round. And then you have to lay it across the griddle. And it's a sort of a very gentle kind of motion to slide your hand out from underneath it so that it doesn't get little air bubbles underneath, which keeps it from browning nicely. And then you have to pull it off and turn it twice. And then if it works out perfectly, it'll puff up and the air inside, or the sort of steam inside, the liquid inside the dough will puff up and it'll cause it to grow. And it'll turn into this little balloon briefly. And that's when you know you've done it perfectly.
And then you eat it within the hour while it's still fresh. That is a lot of work, but get a big bag of masa and you've streamlined the process significantly. Pilcher explains.
There are a number of ways in which people have mechanized the tortilla, right? So one way is to avoid having to take the corn and soaking it and then grinding it and stuff. Is they've got these factories that churn out. It's basically like it's a tortilla dough that just needs to be rehydrated. And you mix it with water and you have to get the right texture, right? You don't want to add too much water, but you don't want it to be too dry either. You know, either way is kind of wrong. And this is, frankly, not as good. I mean, if you know a real tortilla, you know, you will know the difference.
Jeffrey Pilcher, professor of history at the University of Minnesota and author of the book Planet Taco. I don't think I've ever had a real tortilla like he talks about, but I have tasted corn tortillas fresh off the griddle, and they are so much better than the package variety. And, you know, getting people comfortable in the kitchen, making their own food, is what we're all about. So,
we are at Mother Hubbard's Cupboard. We're inside the food pantry where we're doing a demonstration. My name is Kate Young.
Young does cooking demonstrations all the time at Mother Hubbard's Cupboard. The idea is that if the patrons see just how easy it is to make food with the ingredients the pantry offers, and they can taste the results right then and there, they're probably more likely to try it in their own kitchens. We visited Young during the noontime shopping rush. Corn tortilla day.
Tortilla day. We're doing a demonstration on how to make your own homemade corn tortillas. So I am just going to put a cup of cornmeal in here. I don't really know all the exact measurements. I always just kind of wing it with this because it's really a lot about texture.
And you just did a little pinch of kosher salt in there, just a wee bit.
A little. And then the key ingredient to the texture is hot water. And then you just kind of have to either, I guess, wear gloves or be tough-skinned because you do need to knead it a little bit while it's still hot. It's definitely fun to handle and really fun for kids, I think. And I think kids might have some expertise in this area because the way that you know that your dough is ready is that it feels like Play-Doh. That's how you know it's ready. And then you can roll it out with a rolling pin. But the nicest and most fun way to do it is with a tortilla press. And then you just make a little ball. You roll a little ball between your palms, set it down. The ball is about the size of a walnut. And then press.
Poof, there it is.
Yeah.
This is a wee tiny tortilla.
Yes. And then you can put them directly on a hot skillet, or you can cook them in oil. I usually cook them in oil because I'm usually wanting to eat them right away, and they taste delicious when they're cooked in oil.
We'll check in with Kate Young once she gets the skillet up and running. She's going to assemble a little snack for us to try, too. Back with historian Jeffrey Pilcher, before we get a taste of what Kate Young is cooking up, is there a right or a wrong way to eat a corn tortilla? Anything we should know before we load it up with toppings?
Okay, so there's different, actually, ways in which people eat tortillas in Mexico, depending on what they are eating. So, for example, if you're eating mole, you know, which is actually a lot of sauce and whatnot, my favorite way of doing it is actually to roll it very tight. So I'll put the tortilla on my hand, and I'll take my fingers in my other hand, and I'll actually just push them a little bit to kind of just get it started, and then I'll just slide one hand over the other and kind of push it together and rolls it into this tight little cigar, and that way I can dip it into the mole, pull out some mole sauce, and then just eat it. And that's actually a very nice way of doing it. But of course, it has to be a really fresh tortilla, or it'll just kind of crumble up when you try that. Now, if it's a taco, then a couple of different ways of doing that. One is to just sort of lay down something in the middle and kind of fold it over. But, you know, other people sort of make it's sort of like the U-shaped one, like a taco shell, but just kind of holds it that way, too. And you can, you know, it's kind of pinch the tops together. And so, you know, rather than fold it, that's another way of doing it. Actually, my favorite way of eating is actually eating soup with a tortilla. Now, this has to be a really fresh tortilla, but you can actually fold it together. You make a little triangle, and then you kind of fold it together, and it will actually form a cup, and you can eat your soup that way. And watching somebody turn a tortilla into a spoon is really quite a sight.
Okay, now as you can see there's a little bit of bubbling and a little bit of browning on those bubbles, and that's what we're looking for.
Kate Young, mid tortilla fry.
I like to have them where you can see the kind of nice golden brown, little bit of the oil on both sides. And you have to be careful because they will absorb a lot of the oil, so you don't want to put too much in at the beginning because I think they'll just soak it all up. So you just put a thin film of oil down and then flip them. Let's try one, find out.
We've got a bowl of cheese there, so.
Yes, I thought people would want to try them with various toppings. We've got some cheese. Inside, I whipped up a quick salsa this morning. In tomato season, in the late summer, I would probably make a pico or some kind of salsa fresca with, fresh peppers and tomatoes. But this time of year, we used canned tomatoes. Home canned tomatoes, and just sautéed some onions, some garlic, threw in a little oregano, cumin, chili powder, a couple of diced jalapenos, and just cooking it a little bit to develop the flavors, and then we'll use that for a topping.
Like a little Mexican pizza.
Yeah? Yep.
Let me see if I can fold it. They're sturdier than what you get in the package. Like, this is going to hold up.
Tacos.
Still warm. Okay, that salsa.
It's so simple. I mean, it's just like, yeah, there's not much to it.
Wow, thank you. They do such great things at Mother Hubbard's Cupboard. Thanks to Kate Young for that demonstration. More about corn tortillas on the website. We have a mojito recipe, vegan taco recipes as well. Cinco de Mayo for all kinds of eaters. Explore your options at eartheats.org. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Aobon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Will Fellows, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Jeffrey Pilcher, Betsy Shepard, Jana Wilson, Kate Young, and everyone at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. At the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, massage and yoga. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Bloomington Hypnosis, with certified hypnotist and self-hypnosis instructor John Hunkler, helping clients relax into weight loss for health and fitness. Bloomington Hypnosis, 812-200-5005. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Another week of good food in the books. We are Earth Eats. Thanks for listening. I'm Annie Corrigan.